Einstein said that the unleashed power of the atom has changed everything except our modes of thinking, and we drift towards unparalleled catastrophes. And even though we were fortunate that the worst catastrophes he was imagining haven't happened yet, I think those of us who've studied our situation in the 20th century would agree with what he said. Especially after hearing Ray's talk, I think we can see that there's some new kinds of technology that are going to pose us some new kinds of challenges. I'd like to talk, first of all, about my optimism, because my optimism leads me to my concern. I believe genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and robotics can bring almost unimaginable wealth. They can cure diseases, they can end poverty, they can end the need for work. And there could easily be tens of thousands of .geno, .nano, and .robo companies creating trillions of dollars of wealth. And I would, just in your own mind, say what I just said again twice, because I'm not going to say the optimistic part the rest of the talk, because we hear that every day. And I got to tell you some of the less pleasant stuff. But I am optimistic, because if I wasn't optimistic about these technologies, if I didn't believe that the capitalism would drive them forward, then I wouldn't be concerned. The thing that changed for me was not so much meeting Ray in the bar, was when I, in early 1999, met a physicist friend of mine who told me about some things he knew about nanoelectronics and that he saw a clear path to continuing Moore's Law to 2030. And that changes everything, because I had been assuming for more than a decade that Moore's Law was going to run out in about 2010. That additional 20 or 30 years then gives us about a factor of a million increase in performance in the computers, and a factor of a million from where we are today is almost inconceivable. I would point out to you that a factor of a million reduces a millennium to about 8 hours. It reduces a lifetime to a half an hour. It reduces a year to 30 seconds. And you can do more of those yourself than say, well, I don't really understand. I don't in everyday life what a factor of a million is. I think we have an obligation. We're the inheritors of an incredible culture. It's rooted in the Greeks. It's an experiment we've been running in Western culture since the 5th century before the Common Era. There was an interruption, basically, when the Greek civilization fell roughly to the Renaissance. And then the acceleration of our progress certainly began with modern science and technology. Now, the Greeks were both spiritual and objective. And from what I read of the history, I think their objectivity was the key to their success in science and art. Edith Hamilton said, "The Greeks were not tempted to evade facts. It is we ourselves who are the sentimentalists, we to whom poetry, all art, is only a superficial decoration on life. The Greeks looked straight at it. They were completely unsentimental. It was a Roman who said it was sweet to die for one's country. The Greeks never said it was sweet to die for anything. They had no vital lives." And so I think to be worthy of these forefathers, we need to be unsentimental in our current situation. And that means that to be fair, often to seem blunt, and to even say things that are unpleasant, and which I'm going to do today. The 20th century, we had three big overhanging issues: the weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, and chemical. These were developed by the military. They had largely military uses. They had little commercial value. They required large-scale activities, many billions of dollars to develop them, often needing rare raw materials. The uranium for the first few atomic bombs cost more than $1 billion in then current dollars. And the knowledge to create them was closely held in the national laboratories and still is. It's not something you pick up routinely on the web. They're held by a small number of countries. Unfortunately, the world is becoming more multipolar. That's why President Clinton went to South Asia. And we're clearly concerned today about what people would call the loose nuke threat. Someone, I don't know who, said once, "Nuclear fission, a fit technology for a wise, far-seeing, and incorruptible people." And if anyone knows who said that, I'd like to know, I think they were completely correct, because we are not. Now, our 21st century technologies that I think are going to be the root causes of the danger we're going to face are genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and robotics. These differ in almost every aspect that I just mentioned from the ones in the 20th century, in every way making the problem of dealing with them worse. They're being developed by the commercial sector rather than the military. They have both military and commercial uses. They have huge commercial value, as I've already mentioned. there can be developed by small-scale activities, even personal activity on sitting at your personal computer. They don't need any rare raw materials. This is perhaps the most important point. The basic raw material to do things with these technologies is information and knowledge, basically software. It's not secret stuff. In the information age, then, I think it's fair to say, and unfortunately true, that knowledge itself can become a weapon. And this is something that we have not come to terms with in the sense that Einstein was talking about. And so I call the kinds of bad things you can do with these technologies knowledge-enabled massive destruction, or KMDs, by analogy to WMDs. And the difference here is that the ability to do these things is available to individuals and small groups in a way that it never was, because I just listed to you the political entities that control most of the WMDs, and a list of every person who could have access to KMDs is obviously very long. So what's the thing that makes these things more dangerous? It's not just that people can get access to these technologies. It's another aspect of these new technologies. It's self-replication. Basically, if you have a bomb, you can blow it up once. You got to take it where, or somehow deliver it to where you're going to blow it up, and you can blow it up once. But if you release something that can replicate itself in the environment, you can do damage far out of proportion to the single act. A single act with a KMD can cause extreme harm. The fact that by 2030 we're going to be able to build machines that are a million times as powerful as the personal computers of today, and as we combine that computing ability with the ability to manipulate things in the physical and biological sciences and understanding what we're manipulating and being able to simulate it, we open up the opportunity for ourselves to completely redesign the world for better or for worse. So it's no surprise that we can have these unbelievable curves and dreams of doing certain things, because we can imagine using this technology to do just about anything. The replicating and evolving processes that have been confined to the natural world are about to become, as Bacon dreamed, realms of human endeavor. So the real risk we face, in my judgment, and I've worried about and studied this problem now for about a year and a half, is that we're democratizing the ability for individuals to cause great harm. The information technology is a great democratizer. The risk of harm is extremely great because of self-replication. Accustomed to living with almost routine scientific breakthroughs, we haven't come to terms with the fact that these compelling 21st century technologies pose a different threat than the technologies that came before. And uncontrolled self-replication in these newer technologies runs a risk of substantial damage in the physical world. And we're on the verge of empowering just about everybody. And as I say in the article in Wired, I think it's no exaggeration to say we're on the cusp of the further perfection of extreme evil. That's Hannah Arendt's term. An evil whose possibility spreads well beyond that to which weapons of mass destruction bequeathed to the nation states, onto a surprising and terrible empowerment of extreme individuals. The primary danger, actually, in terms of time, is genetic engineering, because so much of the machinery is given to us already in place. People who've gone to conferences that I've heard about say that the scientists involved think we could have widespread designer pathogens in roughly 20 years or maybe less. The problem with designed pathogens is there's no natural limits on the virulence of such things. They don't have to obey the normal rules that you have to obey to stay in the environment. Normally, diseases that are widespread are relatively weak. Normally, diseases and pathogens don't extinct their target species, because if their targets go away, they go away. They co-extinct each other. But if you build one of these things in the laboratory, you don't have to obey those rules. You can get around the normal Darwinian rules that set the context when we think about the real world. We can engineer in the laboratory the level of virulence, contagion, and incubation that we want to achieve whatever objectives we want. And we can certainly easily arrange, given the map of the genome and some understanding of it, that humans have no natural immunity. And what barrier will there be to someone doing this? Well, all the information is public. The information is getting very cheap. The computers are going to be infinitely powerful for design. And the only difference between a good thing and a bad thing is simply a sequence, which may be very, very difficult to understand unless you know what the person's up to. In this context, nanotechnology is just more of the same. And they have different words for these things. Instead of a pathogen, maybe it's gray goo. Now, some people think that nanotech won't work because maybe powering it up is too hard, or replicating it, the machinery is too hard. But the people I know have talked to have told me things that make me believe that they can work around these problems. But frankly, I'm not going to talk about it because I don't know how widespread knowledge of those things is, and I don't think it helps to talk about it. So, and I would also notice that, for me, we don't need to have assemblers in nanotechnology for it to contribute to the danger. Nanoelectronics, which operates, I think, mostly using self-assembly, which is a different mechanism, should be sufficient using self-assembly techniques to give us an assured 10 to the 6 speed up that gets us to the point around 2030 where I think we have a substantial danger. Nanoassemblers then would just be piling on. Now, probably the unpleasant part of this talk is then I'm going to have to talk about what do extreme individuals do with such technology. What they do is they do what we would call pestilences. And unfortunately for us, it's kind of dropped out of our cultural memory. The Black Death in the 14th century, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, was transmitted to Europeans in 1347 when a Kipchak army besieging a Genoese trading post in the Crimea catapulted plague-infested corpses into the town, being used as an instrument of war, and about a third of the population of Europe then died. Smallpox in the 16th century Americas, the turning point in one instance was involving smallpox came when Lord Geoffrey Amherst secured his place in history as the inventor of modern germ warfare by commanding, infect the Indians with sheets upon which smallpox patients have been lying or any other means which may serve to exterminate the accursed race. That's from this wonderful book by Robert Wright called Stolen Continents, which I highly recommend. The thing that some people in the country probably old enough to remember, the last thing that really happened, I'd say, was the influenza epidemic in 1918. But what's happened in the last 50 years or so is antibiotics and sanitation have prevented many or most such things. But if people who've read books like Laurie Garrett's Coming Plague realize the antibiotics are starting to weaken. I think we have very little memory of the plague itself. I'd like to read you a quote from Lucretius about the plague that was visited once upon Athens. He says, "At first they felt their heads burning with fever, throats blackened, sweating blood, the tongue filled up, engorged with blood, became too hard to move. Men's inner parts were burning to their very bones. Their guts were furnaces. The only thing they had to drink was thirst, which made a deluge seem less than a raindrop. Doctors shook their heads while patients stared blankly. The signs of death were obvious. The mind was crazed with grief and fear. 8 days or nine would find the limbs grow stiff in death. There seemed to be no certain remedy. What gave life to one killed others. The plague was most infectious. It could spread as pestilences do with animals, cattle, and sheep. So death was piled on death. None were left sometimes as mourners when the dead were hurried to their graves. Battles broke out as the survivors fought for funeral pyres with corpses heaped on corpses. Funeral rites, which these pious people held in all traditional reverence, became quite out of fashion. Everyone in grief buried his own whatever way he could amidst a general panic. Sudden need and poverty persuaded men to use horrible makeshifts, howling they would place their dead on pyres prepared for other men, apply the torches, maim and bleed and brawl to keep the corpses from abandonment." Okay, well, so let's change the subject. Thankfully, robotics. The threat in robotics is quite frankly different. The threat is what I would call a wild successor species, something that is really out of our control. I believe nanoelectronics probably provides sufficient CPU power. Moravec has well outlined the dangers in his book. I think it's farther out. I judge the bulk of the genetic risk to be less than 20 years out, the nano risk to be less than 30 years out, the robot risk probably 30 plus. All of these failing kind of a Dolly 2 kind of surprise. The real thing that robotics does is it changes the evolutionary paradigm. The biological evolution has clearly been in the back seat since our arrival. It was always a very slow process. It was a kind of a tree-like branching or collapse. But now the whole thing could collapse, frankly, so that neither we nor the robots are on the main trunk going forward. It's a new game again, probably a million times faster. And the robots have an advantage over us, and a very distinct advantage, and basically they're Lamarckian. They can inherit knowledge, memories, and experience, not just through the way we do, through genes and cultural artifacts. So the danger, I think, is really extremists and delusional people. I'd like to read you a quote from a neurobiologist at the University of Washington named William Calvin, who wrote in the Seattle Times the week after the Wired article came out. He said, "There's a class of people with delusional disorder who can remain employed and pretty functional for decades. Even if they're only 1% of the population, that's 20,000 mostly untreated delusional people in the Puget Sound area. Even if only 1% of these has the intelligence or education to intentionally create sustained or widespread harm, it's still a pool of 200 high-performing sociopathic or delusional techies in the Puget Sound area alone." His words, not mine, but you see, he follows to say, try to scale it up to the world and divide by 100 for relative education, you come up with a number that's quite large. So what we're talking about here is whether we're going to give these kinds of people illimitable power. One way, it's hard to think about what that would mean, but what I think about it is, it's like Flight 990, remember where the pilot probably crashed the plane? Just imagine if everybody on the plane is a pilot. How many, and has a button to crash the plane, how many people are going to be pilots with you on the plane before you're willing to get on? Not willing to get on anymore. And imagine the whole planet is full of pilots. How does that make you feel? It really is, I think, a return to fate as we knew it in the ancient world. We've lived over the last 2,500 years with roughly one-on-one or one-on-a-few violence. Now we have this possibility of one-to-many contagions, which enables genocide, extinction, or worse, committed by individuals in a way we've never faced before. Now, people have proposed technical fixes. Eric Drexler, for example, in his book on nanotechnology, proposes shields. The problem with these shields is essentially, primarily in my view, an autoimmunity problem. In other words, you build a shield and the shield attacks you. To shield the human body from any potential pathogen, you basically need a perfect human immune system. I think that's unreasonable to assume. The nano shield against nanotechnology seems like a doomsday machine to me. The shield against robotics is ultimately a perfected version of Asimov's laws of robotics. Louis Alvarez, the Nobel laureate physicist, said of the people who were trying to build the SDI missile defense, very succinctly, "Bright guys, no common sense." And I think that's kind of sums up thinking that we're going to save ourselves with a shield. Arthur C. Clarke said, "A total defense might indeed be possible in a century or so, but the technology involved would produce, as a byproduct, weapons so terrible that no one would bother with anything as primitive as ballistic missiles." So it's quite clear, I think, that shields are worse than the thing they're shielding from. Carl Sagan, in his book Pale Blue Dot, in fact, suggested that the answer to this was to head for the stars. The problem with this is there's not enough time. Many people would be left behind. Who takes ethical responsibility for them? Because the problems will be here, and actually the problems will probably follow us to the stars as well. So it seems to me this isn't a fix either. The fix that Ray Kurzweil proposes, in my mind, is sort of be one with technology. I don't think it really fixes the problem, because I'm sure these problems will exist in whatever new technical substrate that we go put ourselves in, since everything's speeded up. And you can read about the dangerous, super-intelligent, all-powerful robots in Moravec's book. Now, there are some other non-technical fixes. We could hope for a second coming. The problem with this is the way I read, and I have a Bible in my bag, and that seems a little strange, but the way I read these things is I don't think God is necessarily going to intervene. God doesn't intervene to stop suffering. And I'm trying to find this stuff in St. Augustine. I haven't found it yet. But people have thought about this for thousands of years. I'm talking to people in the clergy to try to figure this out. What do different faiths say? I don't think that's good enough, even for people of faith. Atheists, of course, could hope that aliens would show up and save us. So I'm left really with only one thing, which is relinquishment, which is don't develop the things that are just too dangerous. Some of this knowledge and technology is just too much for people at our level, you know, for a species at our level of sophistication. We did renounce the development of biological weapons. The U.S. did that unilaterally. I see Stuart Brandis here. I copied a quote out of a Wired forum that he said, "A potential extinction event is the right language to use. Everyone agrees there's an iceberg. The question is, will it hit the ship, miss the ship, or replace the ship? Or maybe, unthinkable, the ship will slow down and study the iceberg for a while." And I think that's my suggestion. Now, a good question is, how much danger is there? John Leslie says probably a 30% danger, but if I send him the article, he might unfortunately raise it. And that's assuming also you don't accept what's called the doomsday argument, which is roughly that, quote, we ought to have some reluctance to believe that we're among, are very exceptionally early, for instance, in the earliest 0.001% among all humans who will ever have lived. Namely, if humans are going to live for a long time, then you're much more likely to have born after the galaxy was colonized. And so the fact that it hasn't gives us some concern. Ray Kurzweil says that we have a better than even chance of making it through, with the caveat that he has, quote, always been accused of being an optimist. So I think either of these estimates and are far beyond completely unacceptable. And the scary thing about them is they're really only talking about the probability of extinction. There are a lot of other horrid outcomes short of extinction which these technologies will enable. So we really need to talk about ethics. Clearly, the unchecked use of these technologies can cause genocide or extinction. As scientists, I don't think we should be complicit in genocide. We have to put in some proper safeguards to limit development. And this must account for the reality of extremists. I think we have to get beyond what I would call scientific fatalism, just whatever happens, happens, and take some responsibility. For example, I don't think we should risk our future on whatever certain physical constants happen to turn out to be. It was quite responsible before they blew off the A-bomb to try to figure out whether it was going to light the atmosphere on fire and burn down the planet. And, you know, Teller did the calculation, and they finally agreed it probably wouldn't destroy the planet. I think there was a 3 in a million chance. Now, of course, something like experiment like this is going to be run here in, what, a few weeks with the quark gluon plasma strangelet to see if that destroys the Earth using the relativistic heavy ion collider. There was an environmental impact suit filed to try to stop this test because people couldn't figure out what was going to happen. But my understanding is a federal judge apparently decided that the test could go ahead. I hope he took a physics class. So at least that's better than having a crazy person decide the future, say, of your race or your family or something. So the situation we're in seems to come from the fact that scientific attitude reveres knowledge above all. Robert Oppenheimer said, and just after the exploding of the bomb, it's not possible to be a scientist unless you believe that the knowledge of the world and the power which this gives is a thing which has intrinsic value to humanity, and that you're using it to help in the spread of knowledge and are willing to take the consequences. In other words, disclaiming responsibility, which I find appalling, and I read everything I could find that he ever wrote, and he never retracted it. I think KMDs and the bug, I would say, with them forces us to re-examine this attitude. In the article I said, yes, I know knowledge is good, as is a search for new truths. We've, as a bedrock value in our society, long agreed on the value of open access to information and recognize the problems that arise with attempts to restrict access to and development of knowledge. In recent times, we've come to revere scientific knowledge. But despite the strong historical precedents, if open access to an unlimited development of knowledge henceforth puts us all in clear danger of extinction, then common sense demands that we re-examine even these basic long-held truths. Truth cannot be the highest goal. It was Nietzsche who warned us at the end of the 19th century not only that God is dead, but that, quote, faith in science, which after all exists undeniably, cannot owe its origin to a calculus of utility. It must have originated in spite of the fact that the disutility and dangerousness of the will to truth, of truth at any price, is proved to it constantly. It's this further danger that we now fully face, the consequences of our truth-seeking. The truth that science seeks can certainly be considered a dangerous substitute for God if it's likely to lead to our extinction. The Romans recognized that the enforcement of an absolutely just law without any exceptions, irrespective of particular differences, would work absolute injustice. And so while the search for truth is always a good thing, there is always the exception. Aristotle, who founded modern science, in his Nicomachean Ethics said, the final end is not truth, it's happiness. We call final without qualification that which is always desirable in itself and never for the sake of something else. Now such a thing, happiness, above all else is held to be, for this we choose always for itself and never for the sake of something else. This is the exact same point that the Dalai Lama makes in his book, Ethics for the New Millennium, and argues very strongly that we should try to understand what makes people happy, and there's strong evidence that material progress and the pursuit of knowledge are not what makes people happy. Both East and West, at least the West, in the historic times recognized the limits of science. So what do we do now? We have to get more discussion going. I think we have to study the technical and the ethical issues. We have to take lessons from what we learned about nuclear weapons and the weapons of mass destruction. Hans Bethe's called for people to cease and desist in developing weapons of mass destruction. We've had an idea of a Hippocratic Oath for scientists, technologists, managers. We have the Acheson-Lilienthal report and the Baruch Plan, which attempted to internationalize atomic energy to keep it out of the hands of terrorists and from going multipolar. We have the relinquishment experience from biological weapons. We have the verification experience from the biological chemical weapons treaties. And we're also going to have to take any efforts like this into cyberspace and deal with commercial use. So we're going to have to think about how this would affect intellectual property, how we have to change liability law, and how we would verify in cyberspace. So lastly, what I'd like to tell you is what's happened to me in the 2 weeks roughly since the article appeared. I've gotten an enormous number of hopeful electronic mails to my email address, which is not all that public, including a number of scientists and several Nobel Prize winners who have been very supportive. I have organizational interest. In the next 6 weeks, I'm speaking at a meeting of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, American Association for the Advancement of Science, the National Research Council for Science in Canada, the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, and the Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard, which has been working on these issues for 25 years. There's international media interest in this story, and I have to tell you that the length of the media opportunities is increasing. The first week, most of them were 5 minutes. It's up to 20 to 30-minute pieces, so people are taking it and being willing to do it at a serious length. The fears, most of the email I get of people who don't like it say relinquishment is impossible and will make it worse, and collective controls are bad in principle because of government. So I'd say there's a substantial bias to sober hope over fear, and that gives me hope. The 20th century was clearly a century of war. It was a very bloody century. We fortunately avoided the nuclear disaster. We created the ability for nation states to destroy civilization. The 21st century, if we're not careful, will be a century of pestilences, in my opinion, much more like the 14th or 16th. I think we have to change our ways, as Einstein suggested, to avoid such disasters and avoid democratizing extreme evil. Thank you.